accession number 28355, Reel 14.
Hello, Craig. Thank you very much indeed for continuing with your detailed memoir of the period leading up to Gulf War I. May we continue from where we left off, I think. You had gone to Madrid.
Yep, and I think I'm back from Madrid now. On the 18th of September, I note that we were in need to go to Washington. Tonkin was going to go by Concord, and then he didn't particularly want to take me, and eventually we agreed we'd all go together. At one stage he thought it'd be better we didn't even travel in the same aircraft. His life slightly
different. And you felt that because in case of accident?
It's very difficult to predict exactly why Tonkin felt what he felt at any particular time. Yes, it could have been that, but as it happened, we travelled together. As it says here, a thoroughly tiresome day, which I eventually won on Concord with his party of four.
A thoroughly tiresome day.
Yeah. The next thing that comes up in this a couple of days later is the appointment of Peter Lavilliere. The Prime Minister was very keen to have Peter, and we needed to make sure that we got the right command and control organisation with the Joint Commander in Northwood, in High Wycombe rather, at a four-star, which was Paddy Hine. And the issue was really whether it should be a three-star or a two-star out in the theatre.
How did the Prime Minister come to want Peter de Lavilliere among all the various lieutenant generals available?
Because she knew him from his time, I think, in the Iran embassy siege when the SAS. And Peter was about actually to retire, so he was available. When I say about to retire, if he didn't get promoted, he would have retired in the next year or so. But he was a good choice. I was happy with that. And so was CGS. But by this time, Tom King was sort of having second thoughts. I said he would think about it and talk with CGS. So once again, one was going around slightly in circles. At the same time, we're talking about increasing force levels, and this would be adding 7 brigade to the Orbat with about 9,500. And this whole problem of numbers keeps cropping up in this, and I might deal with it a little bit, because inevitably it takes time to work out all the details of what force levels you require, the sort of logistics and the signalers and so on. You can perhaps get the main force right, but the add-ons don't always get thought of, partly because we hadn't done this before. I mean, there was no exercise on which staff could draw and say that, you know, if you want to send another brigade, you need not just 9,500, but you need some other figure. Tom King kept getting hooked on the number, and the operational commanders were quite rightly saying, oh, we need a bit more of this or a bit more there, or get this right. And so the numbers had to be stretched over and above the original 9,500. And for whatever reason, Tom King had felt that once he said a number to the Prime Minister, and that was it, and you couldn't vary it. And I pointed out to him, there's no question of him dining a la carte from what we really wanted, and saying you can only have 9,500 out of that 11,000, whatever the figure was. And there was a good deal of difficulty over that, but it kept recurring. And it's a lesson, I think, for any future organisation to put together, make sure that they don't get caught. It may have to do with the personalities. I think Tom King was sort of very inclined to sort of fix onto a particular figure or a number and think that, you know, everybody was letting down if we didn't stick to it. And he felt he was being made to look foolish. Maybe he was, but if we were really going to go to war, we needed to go to war with the right number of people, not trying to save Tom King's blushes.
How did he arrive at these figures? Who was telling him?
We were put in a submission saying, you know, we want to send 7 brigade, 9,500. But then, as people got down to the detail, they realised that there was a need to add this unit or that unit. So the 9,500 crept up. And it was that creeping up which upset Tom. Maybe he had a point saying, you know, you forgot your staff work right to start with. My response to that was, well, we've never done this before. We're learning as we go. Even Purple Victory, which was an exercise the previous year out in the Middle East, where we were going to send out a sizable force, we hadn't got that to draw on because ministers had scrubbed it the year before. So we were really running around very much in the dark, or whatever. The army units involved were running around very much in the dark, and I certainly didn't feel that they were being disingenuous or misleading or anything like that. They were just finding, as they got down to the detail, that you did need extra drivers or extra communicators or whatever it happened to be, over and above the original. I mean, it's easy to say battalion of X. It's much more difficult to say a battalion group was in this particular theatre needing that particular fueling or whatever communication ammunition. You know, you're going to use ammunition much more, much greater quantities than before, so you need more people to help you handle it than
yes.
You would on an exercise. So
yes.
Even judge it on an exercise, a live exercise, you certainly weren't going to use ammunition at the same rate. Perhaps as you would in a real situation. So, all of these things, for instances, rather than the actual ones, because it's so long ago now I can't remember the details, but those are the sorts of things which were causing this difficulty. And then we went to the War Cabinet, and by the time we got Tom King to mention numbers of up to 11,000, so over the weekend more or less, we managed to get it up for 2 or 3 days, which the PM accepted, but concerned about costs. There was also hospital ships and so on, which accounted for some of the additionals.
Which was one thing for which there was massive over-provision.
Yes,
happily.
Happily in the sense that we didn't get attacked with CW or VW, and our casualties were very, very low. Extraordinarily low. You know, and some of them, I'm afraid, were blue on blue. And finally, by this time, we have got Peter LaBiglia. So it's taken the best part of a week to get Peter LaBiglia finally sorted out. But it was too late to get cleared by the Queen before the weekend. It says, yes. We had to go another couple of days before we announced. So we had a press conference on the 1st of October to announce Peter LaBiglia. And the numbers seemed to have grown to 15,000. Including the hospital to cover the growth in 7 Brigade, which I've been talking about.
So the concept of a brigade, of course, is just the name that's attached to the force, really.
Yes, but a brigade is not a defined number any more than, say, a squadron of aircraft is a defined number of airframes. or even a defined number of people. A brigade, or a division for that matter, or even a battalion. Although they can vary depending on the particular roles or the field they're going to be deployed in. You talk about light brigades and heavy brigades, but even that isn't. That's more symptomatic of the type of weaponry they have,
yes,
rather than the numbers.
And the volume.
And
yes.
The volume. Well, I think we can skip on now a bit. A week or so later, I note that I was talking. Paddy Hine had been out to, he's the joint commander, had been out in Washington and had a good discussion out there. At that time, one of the issues which was really bugging me was the political aims and objectives. Because without those, you couldn't be absolutely clear what your military aims and objectives were going to be. And I had a lot of trouble getting even the Americans to focus in on this. So I remember going out and meeting Schwarzkopf, and said to him...
When did you meet Schwarzkopf?
I'm just trying to remember whether it's it was all about this time. I think it was after the Pavilion. I'm not sure whether it isn't easier to take this. I'm trying to sort of follow the idea of, you know, picking up a subject and running with it. But
yes,
because it's so muddled in this...
As
it happens, it's probably better if I take it as it
yes.
happens.
So if you just maintain a linear...
Maintain my
a linear chronological...
Yeah,
yeah, okay.
Which I am...
If you want me to stop at any time, do.
Yes,
ask.
I think we might stop it for a moment now. As I was saying, at this time, the whole business of what our objectives were, political objectives, because nothing had been written down. I was keen to get this out in the open and agreed with the Americans, because without that, I wasn't going to be very happy that their military objectives and ours, which were matched to the same political objective. Obviously, to get a political objective, you've got to get the Prime Minister and Bush to agree what it was we were trying to do. And this subject kept cropping up. And I wasn't sure really how to sort of get it started. And then I had a very useful half hour with Terry Lewin. I think I mentioned this, which was in early October. And he gave me... I'd approached him. I think I did mention this before.
Yes.
I'd approached him because
yes.
he had been CDS during the Falklands. And out of that came the idea that really let's get the officials of the various ministers, the POSs from the Foreign Office, the Treasury, not the Treasury in this case, the Foreign Office, MOD, myself, the Cabinet Office, together, so that when the War Cabinet met, their ministers were going to be focused on the things that really needed to be talked about. And on this business of political objectives, we had various discussions. I had discussions also with Tom King. I had discussions with Douglas Hurd about it, who was the Foreign Secretary, and also trying to get people to focus in on it, as I've said.
What was Douglas Hearn's, sir? What was the Foreign Office view?
He wasn't very happy about us going to war. He was keener, I think, that we should resolve this diplomatically. And I think Tom King was much of that view too. In the States, Bush was, I think, for going to war. Colin Powell was certainly not to start with. And I was sort of anxious that if we did go to war, we were absolutely clear what it was we were going to war about, what was the objective to be achieved. So there are these various strands running around. I'm not being terribly clear about it because I'm trying to pick up just where it, I mean, after talking to Tom King about this, he did then go and see Cheney in Washington. And
was he Defense Secretary at the time?
Yes. And I had been making the 3 points. Now, what were our political objectives? Was it going to be a joint decision or not that we went to war? Indeed, where did the Saudis, from whose country we were going to mount the war, or a large part of it, were they also on board? And this was obviously a political issue, but it was very important from the military that the Saudis were going to be on board, as well as Washington and London. So there we are, early in October, a long time before all this was starting. I was beginning to push, we've got to get it clear what the political objectives are, and then, from that we can flow the military ones. And were we in for a fight, or were we in for a long haul? By long haul, I mean staying out there, threatening to go to war, keeping pressure on, having embargoes, so stopping people getting in and out of Iraq, and generally blockading any oil coming out and so on. But keeping troops on the ground there for a long time. And eventually, depending on the numbers you had out there, you would have to consider room on. So there was a long-term issue as well in all of this. If the politicians were anxious not to go to war, they had to recognize that we couldn't sit there indefinitely at the numbers we'd gone up to or about to go up to, and sustain that number.
Why was that?
Because there aren't enough troops around to rotate. If you put a very large number of your offensive capability in theatre, and the Americans were going to do it when they added two more divisions or three more divisions to their numbers out there. We added another brigade and supporting troops. We didn't have two further brigades, let alone three or four, which we could send out there with the same amount of armour and so on. That we already had, that we'd drawn down on everybody's capability in order to field the force that we did field. Our engines are pulled from Challengers and Tornadoes and all the rest of it, in order to make sure that you've got a fighting force in theatre. All right, you can hand over from one to the other, but the troops back home didn't have the wherewithal necessary to train so that they could hit the ground running. So you got yourself in a position where you've got a considerable number of troops in theatre. And if you're going to try and sustain that, you're going to have some difficulty, because you can't have a full rotation. So the alternative then is to reduce the numbers out there so you can build up a rotating capability. But that sends a very unfortunate signal. You've got yourself, in other words, if you've jacked yourself up to a fighting force, and you then don't go and fight, you've got yourself a real military problem. And these were the issues which I was very anxious for the politicians to appreciate and to lock on to, and recognise that the start of all this was the political objective or aim. What were we going to do? Were we going to stay there on the ground for a long time, or were we going to go to war? If we did go to war, what would you want us to do? So and you're going to play a bit of semantics about this, because Margaret Thatcher got pretty irritated at one stage, because, I used the opportunity of those war cabinet meetings to talk, not quite this way I'm talking to you now, about them. But then Tom King got pretty irritated because I was, as it were, he thought, trespassing on his topic, which was the political aims and objectives. And I was only bringing it in because the politicians made up their minds on that. It's rather difficult for the military to get their act together and point it in the direction which would be supportive of the political aims. So there was that, what you might call the macro, in fact, I think eventually called the sort of strategic aim, which sort of got, because Margaret Thatcher got Percy Craddock to write a paper about it, which he and I had to sort of pore over to sort of try and point out that the strategic aim was to get rid of the Iraqis out of Kuwait. But then the politics of that had to be married to the military capabilities. And so, you know, eventually we got there. But it's interesting looking back through my notes to see how repetitive this particular issue became. And I haven't managed to come to it in my notes. Maybe this is a better way of doing this particular issue than trying to go through it seriatim. Because when I went out to meet Schwarzkopf, which must have been, I'll find it in here, about mid-October, and I said to him, what's your political directive? And he hadn't got one. Got nothing in writing. Well, that horrified me too. Because...
He was unfazed by it.
Yes, it didn't seem to... maybe I was being over... Well, I don't think I was being over legalistic or anything. But when I say not fazed by it, I don't think it had necessarily occurred to him that he needed to have it. I think... There was much more of the use of the telephone between Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf, and you know, that was the method of communicating rather than a piece of paper. Well, you know, my limited reading of history is that a piece of paper can actually be quite useful. Misunderstandings can be avoided, although less likely. Bits of paper, of course, can be ambiguous too, but they're less likely to be misunderstandings than if you and I have a conversation, indeed as we are now, and what you think I've said and what I think I've said may not actually chime, but if it's written down, there's a little greater chance.
Yes.
That it, and it's that has always sort of been one of my sort of guiding lights, that when it comes to something as important as this, going to war, committing people, putting people's lives on the line, you've got to get that right. And if your political masters aren't prepared to see it in that light, you've got to keep niggling at them till they get it, get the message. You know, and eventually we got there. But it was something which, you know, when I read my notes back, I realised that it was an ongoing issue, and I'd forgotten just quite how much of an ongoing issue it had been. And yet I think it was very, very important. And eventually, you know, when Tom King came into my office on whenever it was, the 15th, I think, of January of 91, said, "We're on tonight." You know, and I got him to write me a bit of paper. I then wrote a bit of paper to send down by my driver to the Joint Commander in High Wycombe. He said, you know, hostilities will start at midnight UK time, or I can't remember exactly,
whatever it was,
3 o'clock out into it. And that then meant that our forces could be committed. You know, I got a political go ahead, and I had given my force commanders military go ahead. But we can't do it any other way.
No.
I wouldn't want to do it any other way. And even then you see the sort of preemptive strikes. I mean, if the Iraqis attacked, well, you've got your rules of engagement, but I mean, I was quite concerned to learn that Schwarzkopf, if he'd been attacked, would have launched off his air tasking order. In other words, he'd have thrown all his aircraft into it without so much as a by or leave, or so it appeared. Well, that worried me, because some of them were ours. And I wasn't quite sure that, you know, that would be right either. So, as far as I was concerned, I don't know what they do today, but I was very keen that we had a clear political understanding. And it comes up much later, you see, right? I'm going off theme, but I think it's helpful. The political objective was to boot the Iraqis out of Kuwait. They shouldn't be there, they had to be got out. And as I think I've said on tape before, if that meant that we had to invade Iraq to do it, were your ministers happy? Yes. Right, well, that's what we did. We weren't required to go to Baghdad and so on. Of course we could have done. But unless you've got that political objective spelt out, I mean, if they wanted to change it and say, all right, now we'll go on to Baghdad, fine, we'll get on with it. But we were not required to go to Baghdad in that political objective, and I think that was absolutely right, too, because the complications would be fetched up in Baghdad in 1991 would have been, you know, 2003 all over, because we hadn't got a thought through plan for what we'd do if we did get there. Whereas I had pressed also that our exit strategy, we couldn't stay in theatre indefinitely, so we wanted to get people back. We wanted to be quite clear what the objectives were there. And one moment you've been told you're doing it too quickly, and next you've been told you're not doing it quickly enough, too slowly enough. So all of that, the politicians, I feel, have to be nailed down, say what it is they want us to do, and then we'll get on and do it. But I'm not going to have a politician thinking vaguely he's telling me to do something, and then when it doesn't go quite as he'd like, turning around saying, why are you doing that? You know, I mean, it sounds like I'm trying to cover my back, but I'm not. I'm looking after people's lives. And I think it's very important. So, there's a theme which runs through that on that particular thing, but I think enough of that.
Well, I would just like to ask one quick question then before we go on to the next thing, and that is then that before you started this exercise of trying to educate the politicians, what did the politicians themselves think their objectives were?
I don't think they hadn't. Yes, so, you know, we can't have the Kuwait Iraqis in Kuwait, but that's the sort of a negative thing. It doesn't say, well, what are you going to do about it? Are you going to allow them to stay there politically, or are you wanting them to get out? And if you want to do that by diplomatic means or by military means, how long are you prepared to try the diplomatic course before you turn to the use of armed forces? These are the political aims and objectives. What do you want us to... Where do we come into this? Because there's a broad strategy, obviously. We can't accept Kuwait occupied by the Iraqis. We, the politicians, think that's wrong. They've got to be got out. And we've got the United Nations backing to do it and so on. But how do we go about getting them out? You know, do we do it diplomatically? Do we do it by sanctions? Do we do it by blockades? Do we do it some other way short of the brute force of the military option? And how long are we going to try this one before we try the other? You know, us guys who are doing the military bit need to know where we fit into this. So you know, you can't just flick your fingers and say, well, I'm fed up trying to be a diplomat. Go get him. I speak facetiously. Right. Let's turn off for a moment.